Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:32 p.m. on Monday, January 26, 2022. Let the record please also reflect that we have a quorum today. Present are Senator Stevens, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Reback. And staffing the committee today is my committee aide, Inti Mayo Harbison, LIO moderator, Talia Ames, and Juliana Singh from Records. Thank you, as always, for your service. This time, please silence or turn off your cell phones. Today's agenda consists of two items, SB 85, an act relating to forest land use plans, relating to forest land use plan appeals, relating to negotiated timber sales, and providing for an effective date, and HB 79, an act relating to sport fishing operators and sport fishing guides, requiring the Department of Fish and Game to prepare and submit a report, and providing for an effective date. So we'll jump right into SB 85. First, we'll hear a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources regarding SB 85. Here to present today, we have Brent Goodrum, the Deputy Commissioner of DNR, and Helge Eng, the Director of the Division of Forestry, the new Director. Congratulations on your position and welcome, Helge. Also online for questions is Allison Arians, Natural Resources Specialist from the Division of Forestry, and Chris Orman from the Department of Law, the Assistant Attorney General. Thank you all again for being here today. Please feel free to put yourselves on the record and walk us through your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Reback and committee members. For the record, I am Brent Goodrum, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. We thank you again for the opportunity to bring before you again Senate Bill 85, a bill that would seek to modernize our timber sales process. The proposed modifications to these statutes will help grow predictability in jobs in Alaska's timber industry, an industry that has longed for more flexible negotiated timber sales necessary to meet the current needs of their intended markets. The benefits of enacting Senate Bill 85 will result in more efficient land use planning and more predictable timber harvests. Importantly, Senate Bill 85 has a zero fiscal note. Presenting Senate Bill 85 this afternoon will be Director Helge Eng, Alaska's new state forester. Director Eng has 42 years of experience practicing forestry and fire protection in the Western United States, British Columbia, and Scandinavia. Director Eng worked for the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection for 30 years in a variety of capacities within both forestry and fire protection assignments. He retired from CAL FIRE as Deputy Director for Forestry and was then appointed as the Director of Alaska Division of Forestry after Chris Mache retired in the early summer of 2021. Director Eng is very excited about the opportunity to lead the Division of Forestry during a critical time as our landscape faces new challenges from increasing wildfire threats and tree mortality from spruce beetle infestation. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 85. And with that, I will hand it over to Director Eng.
Thank you, Chair Reback and committee members, for the opportunity to bring this bill before you. And as the first slide implies, there's really two major categories in this bill. One is the benefits of contractual certainty on forest land use plans, and the second is a more efficient and flexible timber sale process to assist the timber industry. This really just a quick overview of my presentation, and number one, the Southeast Alaska timber industry is struggling to survive, and I'll cover that quickly. Number two, how do we protect timber jobs? And that goes back to the two major points I alluded to. changing negotiated timber sale statutes to allow export and providing contractual certainty by making forest land use plans not appealable. And lastly, a sectional analysis if the committee is interested in hearing that.
Thank you, Helge. And if you wouldn't mind real quick, I'd like to welcome Senator Von Imhoff has been with us for some time. And sir, if I could ask you to please pull the microphone up close to your mask there, that would help. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the timber industry in Southeast Alaska is struggling to survive. The U.S. Forest Service repealed or are in the process of repealing the exemption from the roadless rule for the Tongass National Forest. This resulted in an more or less instant shutdown of old growth timber sales from the Tongass National Forest, which, needless to say, is a severe blow to the timber industry in the Southeast, which has grown accustomed to depending on a reliable supply from the Tongass National Forest for literally decades. And the state has responded, the governor has responded by increasing the amount of state timber. And this bill to make the timber sale process more streamlined, flexible, and efficient for purchasers of state timber. And as you can see, the Southeast Alaska timber industry jobs are a sobering statistics, and these jobs are now literally in danger. And we're hoping that SB 85 will help support the local industry. How can we provide and protect jobs? And this would be changing negotiated timber sale statutes to allow exports. Currently, negotiated timber sales must be sold for local manufacturer. And there's a couple of reasons why this change makes sense. A changing timber supply, as I alluded to, the young growth supply is quickly vanishing. More young growth means that some sizes of timber are not marketable in Alaska. Demand for certain species, such as hemlock, is only overseas or in the lower 48 Pacific Northwest. A quick review of types of timber sales. Negotiated sales allow the division to choose a purchaser, often when there's only one bidder, if there are several bidders. In the majority of cases, we go to competitive timber sales where the highest bidder is selected. Part of the issue is that local operators typically are or often are not able to outbid larger out-of-state companies for competitive sales. And this would have a negative effect on the local industry.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Not related to this slide at all, but does this bill deal with the entire state, so all of state forests, not just Southeast, right?
Correct. It's statewide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
How to protect jobs. Once a timber sale has been purchased, the logic is that a stable and predictable supply of timber to the operator by providing contractual certainty is critical. And a appeal of a forest land use plan can literally halt harvesting after the sale has been purchased. And needless to say, this could be ruinous to a logging company, which typically does not have a lot of spare capital to wait for an appeal to be resolved. So SB 85 really ensures that once the decision has been made to sell the timber, no further administrative appeals can occur. I think it's important to mention, however, that appeals, while not allowed, DOF will still continue to engage in the public input process. Only the appeal option would be eliminated. It's very common for public input on forest land use plans to result in modifications of harvest units, such as setbacks for visual considerations, nearby residential areas. And the division really works hard to make timber sales with community support and acceptance. So it's really quite common for, or in most cases, the division will act on and implement public requests before it gets to the appeal stage.
Maybe we'll take a question real quick from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just to confirm, are we talking about state land, federal land? Because on slide 3 it says dwindling supply of timber from the U.S. Forest Service. So which land are we talking about? And are we talking about, and of course then you, so we'll ask that first, then I have a follow-up question.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, this is for state lands only. The slide 3 reference to Forest Service timber supply was to set the stage for why the local timber industry is now in trouble.
Okay. And then how many acres of state land do we have available for timber harvesting?
I will have to get back to you on that. I don't have the exact number.
Could you please send that to my office and we'll distribute it to the committee?
And possibly a map?
Absolutely. We can do that.
Thank you. And is that it, Senator Von Imhoff?
For now.
Good morning. Okay. We have a question from Senator Michiki as well.
So in the absence of an appeal, and I'm obviously a pro-timber guy and want to support the industry, in fact, want to expand the industry, but how does the absence of an appeal process work for the public, where the state may choose a project adjacent to someone's dream home in the middle of nowhere that suddenly finds they're going to be living next to a pile of stumps for 20 acres for the rest of their lives? How would that work? Or when we get the map, would we find that these are all remote locations that aren't going to have that kind of community impact?
Through the chair, Senator McKitchy, that is a good question, and I just switched to the next slide to help answer that. There are literally 5 steps in a timber sale on state lands, ranging from general area plans to specific state forest plans, 5-year scheduled timber sales, the best interest finding, and finally the forest land use plan, which is the one that Senate Bill 85 proposes to be non-appealable. So the public has 3 opportunities for review, input, and appeal. The best interest finding really is where the majority of public opinion and input occurs, and it focuses on whether or not we should sell the timber. The forest land use plan is more of a engineering calculation. Once it's been decided to sell the timber, how will the timber sold be harvested? So that gets at things like road layout, culvert sizing, which arguably is probably not a public input discussion issue. So the plan is that the public, or the logic behind SB 85 is that the public will have plenty of opportunity during the first four stages for input and appeal. And the forest land use plan will be non-appealable to provide that contractual certainty and avoid that possibly redundant appeal of issues that have already been appealed in earlier stages. And adding to that, as I mentioned earlier, appeals are not really that common on state lands. We take some pride in resolving public concerns before it gets to the appeal stage, and the visual quality issue that you mentioned, we have resolved in a lot of cases, or majority of cases, by providing additional buffers in response to public concerns.
Thank you. Please continue.
Lastly, before getting into specifics, just elaborating a little bit on the safeguards on timber harvest. They, of course, must adhere to the Alaska Forest Resource and Practices Act, which protects public trust resources like fish, water, wildlife habitat, as well as ensuring reliable reforestation. And the division is charged with enforcing FERPA through inspections and directives and stop work orders and civil fines. And on state administered sales, the operator is held to the timber sale contract. Every contract includes a bond, so the contractor has to put down a performance bond, which it acts as a guarantee that legal requirements will be met. And last point is division has the ability to shut down operations if violations are seen.
And I think you will grab a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your comments about fish habitat. I just want to make sure that, well, I grew up in Oregon, and we destroyed the fisheries down there by cutting timber right to the edge of the rivers and streams, and I hope it's not a choice of one or the other, that we can maintain both a healthy industry, fishing industry, and a healthy forest industry. Can you comment, how do you do that? How is that done? What protections are out there to make sure that we're not damaging the fisheries?
The Alaska Forest Resource Practices Act and the rules and regulations are, in fact, some of the most rigorous on the West Coast. And including Oregon, which has now focused their rules and act on hydrology and riparian protection, similar to Alaska. And we have quite rigorous requirements for buffers, buffer zones around all streams, and operations are restricted in those zones, and the sustained yield mandate also protects against over-harvesting through requiring that you can only harvest as much as you grow at most, thereby ensuring that forests will regenerate after you harvest and you get new young forests growing back, protecting soil, water quality, and against erosion. So the Act and the rules has really as some of their major focus, protection of water courses and riparian areas.
Thank you. So you feel that we can have it all. We can have a healthy industry as well as a fit timber industry as well as a healthy fisheries.
I absolutely believe we can have both, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Is there a replanting requirement? So once a section has been logged, is there they replant it with the same type of species of tree?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is a reforestation requirement in this area, Southeast Alaska. Trees regrow quite readily. You may not have to replant, but there is a requirement in the Act and the rules for a certain amount and type of tree species after harvest. So yes, there are rigorous requirements for restocking with a natural species mix, similar to what was there before harvest.
Follow-up.
So then different subject here. So at the end of the slide, when you start talking about cost nothing, zero fiscal note, can you also just talk about if there's sometimes fiscal notes have revenue, how will this generate revenue to the state?
The bill, if passed, will allow industry to be more nimble and effective in implementing timber sales. And there's probably a quantifiable revenue impact, although that is unknown at this point.
To follow up?
Well,
if we have a per fish tax, for example, would it make sense to have a per log tax, even if it's just pennies?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that. And, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. And I'd have to ponder that before really having an opinion on it.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
So,
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, Senator Machicki, I'll get to you.
I'm sure this time.
Yes. Okay. Sorry, Senator Machicki. Go ahead.
So, but these are timber sales. So someone has to bid on the acreage. That's revenue to the state, right? Isn't that what we're talking? We're not talking about donating timber to timber companies. How does a timber sale work? Is it the department advertises a piece that will be available, or a timber company can come to the state and say, and I'm hoping this piece becomes available, and then it's a competitive bid? How does, I mean, there's revenue and more fisher tax per pound, but and there is one, but how does it work?
Through the chair, Senator McKechnie, I apologize if I misunderstood the question, but every timber sale on state lands, of course, is revenue to the state. And I interpret the question as to whether SB 85 would provide additional revenue over and above business as usual. Timber sales. Let's see if I have a. Timber sales are either competitive, as you said, they're advertised and awarded to the highest bidder, highest responsible bidder, or they're negotiated. In either case, it's a transaction of allowing a purchaser to harvest timber in exchange for a payment to the state.
Follow up. So what you were saying earlier is you're expecting additional income because of a streamlined process, but it's difficult to quantify. But just logic would say that if you've got a streamlined process and interested bidders, that you would likely have more timber sales, and of course you double the size, which leads to efficiency on the 20 acres and under, so that becomes more attractive.
Correct. It's hard to quantify in the sense that, going back to one of the earlier slides, SB 85 is intended to help a struggling industry, and how do you quantify the risk of a timber company going bankrupt and the loss of revenue and jobs versus keeping that company going. So we expect that SB 85 will have a positive effect.
Senator Kawasaki has been patiently waiting for quite some time while I've overlooked him. Please go ahead.
Yeah, patiently. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did have a question, just sort of dovetailing off the question from Senator Von Imhoff regarding whether they have to reforest or replant. At what point in the current steps of a timber sale would that be required? So this is basically, I'm still on slide 8. Would that be done at the area plan level, the state forest plan level, the 5-year schedule, timber sales level, the best interest finding, or the FLOP?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the reforestation requirement applies after the forest land use plan and after the timber harvest has been completed.
So follow up?
Oh.
So, I mean, and part of this, you know, part of this, a major significant part of the bill deals with the appeals process. And I guess, wouldn't a person want to know that up front before the forest land use plan goes into effect? I mean, wouldn't people who, you know, care about the environment, for instance, or care about the fishery or want to see it reforested, isn't that sort of the thing that a public should know up front?
And, you know, we do have legal online, too. Maybe we can.
And while we're waiting for legal, if I understand your question, absolutely, the public has a right to know. And it is a requirement in the act that adequate reforestation is achieved at a certain point in time after harvest. If not, the Division of Forestry has authority to require that. The point being that at some point you have to approve a timber sale, and a reforestation by necessity takes place after the timber is harvested, if that makes sense.
Maybe we'll Christopher Orman, are you online? And if you are, please put yourself on the record and let us know if you've been listening, if you can have anything to add.
Senator Rivak, this is Christopher Orman. Just for the record, Department of Law and Natural Resource Section. I have been following. I've been here the whole time just to be clear. I think as far as answering that question, I'll go back. So the best interest finding is that the document that's determining, and the decisional document to be clear, that's determining whether or not the timber should be sold. Within that best interest finding are certain requirements that have to be met within those requirements. And one of the requirements in a best interest finding, and there are several online that you can look at, is compliance with FERPA and those requirements that are built into the best interest finding. So hopefully I'm answering Senator Kawasaki's question, which, by the way, apologies for not saying through the chair as to that question, that to answer that question, that the best interest finding is appealable, and the best interest finding has built into it the requirement to comply and to meet certain standards pursuant to the harvest of timber. And as has already been discussed, the forest land use plan is as I like to say here, and I hope I'm not oversimplifying it, and I hope it doesn't confuse anyone, but is kind of the operational plan. It's now saying, okay, the timber has been sold, how is it actually going to be harvested pursuant to the best interest finding that has those requirements?
Okay. That clarifies it, but I did have another question on that.
Yes, thank you, Senator Kawasaki, the follow-up.
Yeah, thanks for being on Mr. Orman. Then I guess the question on the forest land use plan that you just mentioned was that how the timber that is on the land will be harvested. Is there no point before that that the public will have that knowledge? Either in the best interest findings or in some other document, whether it's the state plans that are appealable, the state forest plans that are appealable, or the best interest findings. I guess it's those three.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. Absolutely, yes. And it's somewhat an oversimplification to say that the best interest finding deals with should the timber be harvested, the forest land use plan is how should it be harvested. It's a useful distinction to draw the difference between those two planning documents. In reality, going back to the five stages, reforestation and other aspects of how the timber is harvested are clearly embedded in the earlier plans, ranging from the area plans to the state forest plans to the five-year schedule to the best interest finding. It's just a useful distinction between best interest finding and forest land use plans. But
thank you, Mr. Orman. Do you have anything to add?
No, I don't. I apologize for stepping on Helgi's toes there. No, he answered the question how I would have. Nothing further.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My experience, Mr. Orman's an energetic attorney. a question I think for Mr. Enge. You just said that the design of the sale is to a great extent in the best interest finding, but you said earlier that the land use plan is where the road goes, where the culverts go, and I assume the stream crossings or bridges. That I think is one of the keys that gives me pause in the bill. I'm just trying to think of this in terms of stuff I've handled before, worked on before. Alaskans will sometimes say, yeah, I'm fine with building a bypass road uphill. I got a long driveway. But if the culvert, that 36-inch culvert goes right above their house, they want something to say about it, right? They are deeply concerned. And I think that goes to Senator Stevens' concern about habitat. So can you help with what's in the best interest finding and what's in the FLUP, or the forest land use plan, sorry, I shouldn't use the acronyms, about what Alaskans are going to want to comment on?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the best interest finding is really focused more on the general aspect of the general area-wide consequences of a timber sale, and does it make sense to have a timber sale, for example, in a particular watershed where there has been three or four previous timber sales in the last few years, and ecological other aspects, recognizing that it's the transition between a best interest finding and a forest land use plan is somewhat gradational in the gray area. The forest land use plan is really more of an engineering document. Once the public has commented on the wisdom of having a timber sale in a given watershed, potentially nearby a community, and appropriate viewshed buffers, ecological concerns have been mitigated, then the issue of where does the road go, what's the appropriate size of a culvert to handle a potentially 100-year storm, is viewed as more of an engineering calculation and should not be subject to an appeal. The public has had the opportunity to appeal three previous documents, and again emphasizing that we don't usually get appeals. We do respond. At a recent timber sale near Thorn Bay, we put in viewshed buffers to address public concerns and mitigated to the point where the public was, in fact, satisfied with the timber sale.
Just so I can understand that a little better, right? We have a timber sale. It goes through all the public processes before it's approved. Is that correct? And then next is the FLUP, or the Forest Land Use Plan. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. In fact, in a lot of cases, the best interest finding and forest land use plans are done at the same time. The cases where you would have forest land use plans materializing after the best interest finding would be on large sales, where it would not make sense. It would be very time consuming and expensive to develop forest land use plans for all the harvest units at the same time. The purchaser would have to wait a long time. So in those cases, you would have a best interest finding for the entire timber sale, and then you would develop forest land use plans for harvest units sequentially after that,
as needed. Okay.
Using roads that have been put into the first harvest units to leverage planning forest land use plans and subsequent harvest units.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Senator Machicki.
So the on page 8, when it talks about forest land use plans, it says not all forest land use plans must be issued before timber is offered for sale. I understand that can occur at the same time, but I see two statements. Should we sell this timber? Perhaps your answer is yes. How will the sold timber be harvested? So looking out for the, we've talked about the environmental aspect on kind of one side, make sure that all the precautions are in place, but kind of speaking for the timber industry, I'm a businessman. I'm not going to bid on something before I know whether or not. I mean, you bid, just throw numbers out there, $30,000 for a 20-acre parcel to harvest, and then I find out the reforestation will cost me $15,000 afterward. It seems like something is either out of order or I'm not understanding something.
Through the chair, Senator McKitchie, the intent with the statement is that forest land use plans can be developed over time. The bid on the sale is done with as high a degree of certainty as can be expected for a timber sale. For example, the reforestation requirement is known, and an experienced operator will will know beforehand what he is likely within certain bounds to have to expend on reforestation. So the flexibility with forest land use plans actually serves both the purchaser and the division well in terms of flexibility in implementation.
Thank you. Please continue.
I think we have covered this slide, and that brings us to the sectional analysis and my question to the committee, whether you would want to go through this portion of the presentation, which was also provided last year, but I will be happy to go through.
If you could please give us an abbreviated run through right after Senator Stevens, and if we have questions, we'll get back. Senator Stevens.
I apologize for my lack of knowledge about the timber industry, but how did we ever get to the position that timber industry wasn't able to export? Why is that in statutes? Whoever thought of that they could not export their supplies, had to be used locally? Where does that come from, and why would we ever do that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this is a fairly common requirement in a lot of areas to protect domestic timber industry and facilitate, encourage, provide incentives to domestic processing facilities, the logic being that domestic processing to value-added products will provide more jobs as you're cutting round logs into 2x4s and plywood domestically, as opposed to exporting the round logs to China and just getting paid once. It's a notoriously difficult financial question, and it's not settled. It probably varies whether domestic or export is the way to go. In Southeast Alaska and Senate Bill 85, the proposal is that we need both. We need the ability to export. We need the ability to provide domestic manufacture. Historically, the division has, in the overwhelming majority of sales, government competitive sales, and been domestic. And proposal here is that we need to be able to take advantage of market signals and respond to constantly changing supply and demand factors. So to have both export and domestic available.
Thank you. You've explained that well, and I appreciate that we want to make sure we provide for the local economy, for local housing and building and all that sort of thing. But it does seem like it puts a terrible restriction on the industry, and it sounds like it's possible to do both. How can we make sure, and does this bill make sure, that you can supply local as well as do export? I mean, by passing this, are we denying local folks the opportunity to get timber supplies?
I do not think so. I think this bill is in fact intended to provide the flexibility to export as well as supply the domestic market. So to have both tools available in our toolkit, depending on...
Your department have the authority to make sure that there is that balance, that there is enough local supplies?
In a word, yes. The commissioner... of the Department of Natural Resources decides on the particulars of the timber sale, and Section 2 of the bill has the specific criteria in SB 85 that the commissioner would consider in deciding on the type of that sale.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that that helps me understand where we're going.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Just to expand on that a bit. I think that if the state is considering two companies, one out-of-state and one in-state, bidding on the land, and perhaps the in-state, it has a lot of things going for it in that it doesn't have the transportation costs of moving the logs out-of-state, has the timber processing in-state, but still it does require a significant investment and may not have the funds to do as high of a lease. So the state, what you're saying is the state then, if I'm getting this correctly, can choose, I'm pretending these numbers, a lease for $1 million for an out-of-state California company versus a lease for $850,000 for, let's just pretend these are these numbers, for an in-state company. The commissioner has the choice to choose an in-state company. Correct? Even though it's less money?
In that word, yes.
Okay. So, thank you. And I hope that, because what I'm hearing with constituents emailing is that we have already, before this infrastructure bill, shortages in affordable housing and military housing and teacher housing and senior housing and transitional housing. And housing requires 2x4s and plywood. And I think the cost of those items have gone up already significantly. And I would guess is Alaska's importing a lot of that lumber right now, when we're sitting on well more than 500,000 board feet of timber. I don't know how much state land there is, but wouldn't it make sense for Alaska, you're talking about Grow Alaska, Senator Kawasaki, about trying to revitalize the timber industry so we could be self-sufficient and start building all of these necessary housing and providing that very expensive timber ourselves? It's not all going to big log homes. It's going to 2x4s and plywood.
Through the chair, Senator Wallnemoff, you've highlighted an excellent question that forest industry has been grappling with for probably the last 50 years, and we continue to adapt to as supply and demand equations change. But you're absolutely right, and the division is working actively to incentivize and facilitate investments in domestic processing. That includes working with the governor's office on incentives, perhaps low interest loans, other incentives, and it's rapidly changing. Supply and demand is rapidly changing. It's a difficult problem to solve. As an example, Canadian lumber imports are always in the background, and depending on whatever lumber tariffs are in place for Canadian lumber, that can greatly influence the equation. Windstorms in southeastern United States can suddenly produce a glut of southern timber. So I'm just mentioning this to explain that it's not a fixed target that we need to achieve, but it's ever-changing. And we are working on incentivizing the domestic industry, certainly in Southeast Alaska, and would welcome your ideas on how best to do that. On the other hand, we also want to maintain the existing timber industry and make sure that they stay afloat in addition to incentivizing new investments.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. That is a real good point. This is Alaska grown timber. We have another bill to get to, and I think we'll probably leave this here. We can kind of go through the sectional analysis. One thing that I'm interested, real quick before we move on, you mentioned a couple things, and maybe just very quickly, You mentioned contractual certainty. We've had some support letters from small business and Fairbanks and other places that are in support of this, saying that it will make it easier and more efficient. They use words like more certainty, contractual certainty jumped out at me. Could you please explain very quickly, if we don't pass this bill, what will be the effect as opposed to if we do? In just very layman's, very quickly, and we'll leave it at that.
Chair Vivek, the likely outcome is largely unknown, but Senate Bill 85 is proposed in order to solve a problem, and so the logic behind proposing the bill is that there is a problem with appeals that can stop a small to medium timber company in its tracks after it has purchased a timber sale and is ready to operate. And that could literally put the company out of business.
So essentially what you're saying is that there's a feeling that some folks have figured out how to stop the process. Maybe what some might feel is frivolous. Is that it? Where they're using the system of appeals against the process of timber sales and FLUP. Is that right?
Clearly the public has a right to comment on timber sales. The five-step process, I think, is a good illustration of the fact that the process could be more nimble and efficient. Not every timber sale needs five levels of public go-around and comment. And this would be one.
The sale does. Five rounds?
Five rounds.
Okay. Separate from the forest land use plan.
Including the forest land use plans.
Okay. Well, we're going to, just so I can be be respectful of everybody's time, we're going to leave it there. We're going to set this bill aside. We'll have plenty of time to ask questions and write. If you guys have questions, we'll be glad to ask it before we bring this bill. We will be hearing it again, I assume, or my intent is in the next week or so. So thank you very much for being here, Helge. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you
very much. We're gonna move on to HB 79, an act relating to sport fishing operators and sport fishing guides. Here to present, we have the commissioner of the department, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, also one of my constituents, Doug Vincent Lang. Commissioner Vincent Lang, thank you for being here. We have online for questions Dave Rutz, Director of Sport Fish, ADF&G, and Tom Tabe, Division Operations Manager, ADF&G. Mr. Commissioner, thank you for being here again. Please put yourself on the record and walk us through this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Doug Vincent Lang, and I'm privileged to be the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to HB 79, legislation that was introduced by the governor and is a department priority. With this bill, the department would like to reinstate the saltwater licensing and reporting requirements. Before amendment in House Fisheries and passage by the House last year, it did not reinstate the freshwater licensing or reporting requirements because the department did not see an immediate need for this kind of reporting in freshwater at this time. However, in House Fisheries, the bill was amended to require licensure of freshwater operators and guides, but not require reporting by them. This was accompanied by a reduction in licensure fees for both freshwater and saltwater guides. This change has caused some concern with the freshwater operators and guides across the state. The bill was also amended in House Finance to include a resident and non-resident licensing fee differential. The amended version of the bill was passed by the House last year and is now before you. Before I go any further, let me provide you with a little bit of legislative background on this issue. The sport fish guide and operator licenses were first adopted in the 2003-2004 legislative session and took effect in 2005 and remained in effect until December 31st, 2014, when they expired due to a sunset clause. This legislation was passed based on the urging of both fresh and saltwater guides who were looking to professionalize their industries and ensure the department had information necessary to manage their fisheries. During the 2015 to 2016 legislative session, only the saltwater licensing and reporting requirements were reinstated with the sunset of 2018. The legislators stripped the freshwater piece from the legislation, and the department supported this, as we were not using the freshwater information for in-season management or assessment of fisheries. Again, and we were seeing minor logbook violations. For example, an error in the reporting of the number of grayling released results in loss of concession permits, notably in federal lands. This legislation sunsetted again in 2018. The legislator has provided some bridge funding through UGF, but that has since gone away. As such, we have no legislation in place to collect fees to pay for the Marine Logbook Program. Logbook data has been collected by the department from saltwater sport fishing businesses and guides since 1998 and is critical to upholding the state's U.S.-Canada Pacific Salmon Treaty obligations, providing data to the International Pacific Halibut Commission crucial to making allocation and management decisions. It is also critical for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council for managing federal fishing, ensuring we don't have duplicative reporting requirements and undue burden on the charter industry. And logbook data also supports a myriad of additional critical uses, including but not limited to state fisheries monitoring and management, advisory announcements and emergency orders, Alaska Board of Fisheries processes, advisory committees, etc. Let me give you an example, kind of the utility of this information in the management of saltwater fisheries. Last year, we saw significant decreases in tourism across Alaska, which resulted in significant reductions in saltwater charter boat fishing. We used data from this logbook program to show that we would be significantly below our catch quotas for halibut in the charter industry, and were able to use the data to relax regulations enacted by the IPHC and allow the charter boat fishing some additional opportunity. This resulted in increased participation in halibut charter fisheries, mainly by Alaskans. It also provided a needed economic boost to the charter fisheries and their local economies. Fees collected as part of this bill would provide the data necessary to manage marine charter fisheries off Alaska. These fisheries support somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 angler days of effort and contribute over $1.5 million to the state's economy. In sum, the department supports this bill as introduced by the governor and see it as a necessary tool to fund and manage saltwater charter fisheries. We urge your support in moving this bill out of committee. Thank you. If the committee would like Ms. Hanke to walk you through the sectional analysis, we can bring her up, and both her and I will be available for questions.
Please, while Ms. Hanke is coming up to do a very abbreviated sectional analysis walkthrough, we're going to hold this bill as well, so we'll have plenty of time to ask questions and look through the sectional. And any specific questions we have, we can get to before we pick up this bill again. Any questions for the commissioner? All right, Sankey, please put yourself on the record and give us a very abbreviated sectional.
Thank you. Rachel Hanke, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. Section 1 establishes the license fees. For residents, this is $100 for guide, $200 for the combo license or the operator license. It also establishes non-resident sport guide license at $200 and a non-resident operator and combo license at $400. Section 2 is the largest part of the bill, and this provides stipulations for the sport fishing operator license, defines the license type, does things such as provide stipulations for the sport fishing guide license and combo operator license, and also has definitions and violations and penalties and things like that. Section 3, this just adds saltwater sport fishing operator and guide license to AS 2527244, which is just definition of license in statute. Section 4, uncodified law, which directs the department to prepare a report for the legislature proposing solutions to gathering harvest data for saltwater rental and unguided fishing industry. This is due December 1 of 2022, so this, if it stays in the bill, we need to probably update that date. Section 5, effective date January 1, 2022. This will also need to be updated as well. That's it. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Good to see you again. So years ago, we were looking at raising the fees for commercial fisheries based on whether you were resident or non-resident. I seem to remember the courts entered into it and said you can only raise them as much as you can show you are investing in the. So is there, this is a doubling. Can you justify that? I mean, are we spending enough money in fishing game that we can justify doubling it for? Do you remember that argument, Commissioner? Maybe you help me understand. I may not remember it exactly, but we just could not raise the commercial fisheries, could not raise the fees beyond a certain point.
So there was quite a debate about this in House Finance where this amendment was put on the table. It's a Carlson case, which basically says you can't charge not a business more to operate in the state than the relative cost of increase in cost of managing that for a non-resident. And typically that's about 3-1. So the House Finance Committee settled at a 2-1 differential, and the advice they got from the lawyers was that was probably going to be defensible.
Defensible, yes. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you don't have the numbers, Commissioner, that's fine. I guess my question is currently how much does it cost to implement this at the department level? Is it straight the $600,000 or so that is required to perform the duties of the logbook program for the to meet the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the Halibut Act?
Through the chair, it's probably a little bit more than that, but we're getting some limited funds from the Halibut Commission and from the Salmon Treaty to do portions of this logbook program. This does the unrecoverable costs associated with this program.
And then just as a follow-up, I guess can you just run me through a little bit more about how this was funded prior to 2004 or 5, and then how it's, and then what that bridge funding was in the last, 2018, 2019.
Right? So originally we funded this when we started it just through the Fish and Game Fund and DJ dollars. And then once it became, the guide industry at the time early on was very interested in professionalizing their industry, getting standards and using this information for economic analysis and other things. So they actually pushed for the original bill to have licensing of freshwater guides and saltwater guides. However, it became very controversial very quickly on the freshwater piece because the information wasn't being used by us, but it was being used against the industry. So they were very successful in letting the sunset die and the bill going away. At that point in time, the department still had obligations. We just started funding it through a little bit of UGF that we had in the sport fish division plus DJ and federal aid dollars. But as the bill didn't get reapproved, and we lost it, the legislature originally provided some bridge funding through UGF, but that has since disappeared over the time. So when we were talking to the governor's office about ways to reduce our dependency on UGF, we decided that we would reintroduce this bill, at least on the saltwater piece, to recover some of those funds. And the saltwater industry is very supportive of having most of the saltwater guys are very supportive of paying for this. Some aren't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Senator Keel, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner caught himself, as I did occasionally, making the mistake of assuming commercial fishermen agree on anything, or sport fishermen for that matter. it's a good bill. Appreciate the department bringing it to us. Question about sort of threshold, where it kicks in. Where do we hit the level of fishing guide services or what's the term, guide operator, fishing operator license services? If I rent you a boat, a bunch of rods, and sell you bait, do I need this? If I put a bunch of highlighter marks on your chart, do I need this? Does it only kick in if I go out and say, cast now, troll at this depth? Where does this kick in?
It kicks in when you're accompanying an individual guiding. That's the current definition of guiding. So it does not cover the rental boats at this point in time.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Any additional questions?
Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hanke, Commissioner Vincent Lang. Appreciate you being here. here's what I intend to do. I'd like to open public testimony on this bill, and we actually overlooked public testimony under the previous bill, and so I didn't realize we had people online, and so I'd like to get back to that after we take public testimony in this bill. The intent is to roll back if there's no objections, move to public testimony on the previous. Okay, so with that, public testimony on HB 79 is open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Okay, we don't see any. There are some online. I see Ed Martin. Ed, if you can hear us, could you please put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes?
Yes, my name is Ed Martin, Jr. I'm a 56-year resident of the state of Alaska. I reside in Chennai on Lawton Street. I would like to have testified on the timber one and this one, but if we're going to go with the sport fishing and saltwater fishing licensing issue, I believe that there's not a problem with the resident license cost as a fee, both as a resident guide and an operator. I think those fees are probably okay, but for a non-resident, I think they should be significantly larger. In fact, a non-resident guide should be at least $1,000, an operator $1,500. And maybe both combined, give them a little bit of a break, at $2,000. And the qualification for this is this. I believe that the state of Alaska cries and moans about how they can income tax people so they can collect some kind of tax or something from out-of-state workers, okay? But yet we pass up the opportunities for others that come to our state and operate. And we're not getting enough from them, regardless of the tax, income tax status. I believe these are jobs that Alaskans can do. In fact, there's a whole bunch of non-resident guides on the Kenai River that I'd like to see disappear. Okay? And I've been on the Kenai for many, many years. The same with the fishing industry. I really think that you folks are passing up a heck of an opportunity to get revenue from non-residents. And some of them will cry from the tourist industry on this. But there's only going to be the ones that are non-residents that are coming up here to utilize and capture our resources. And they'll use the tourism industry as the crutch for which they may qualify themselves. So, Doug, I think you did a great job of presentation. I implore upon you folks to think about this really seriously. Because coming up with an income tax that'll tax all of us when you have revenues otherwise, I think that's appropriate to you to look at this a lot. And it could be for hunting also. Absolutely. Double, triple, quadruple those fees. Now, if you want testimony on the timber, I'm uniquely qualified to testify on that also, Senator Reebok.
Sounds good, Mr. Martin. Just stay on the line. We'll get there in just 1 second. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify for HB 79? I don't see anybody. Okay. With that, we're going to close public testimony on HB 79. And as I mentioned previously, we're going to pick back up under previously heard bills, SB 85, an act relating to forest land use plans, and we're going to open public testimony. Public testimony is now open on SB 85. We do have some folks on the phone. Kari Noor from the Resource Development Council for Alaska. Kari, if you're online, could you please put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes?
Good afternoon, Chair Reeve. and members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Kari Knorr, and I'm the project manager for the Resource Development Council for Alaska, commonly referred to as RDC. And I'm calling to testify in support of Senate Bill 85, and RDC has also submitted written comments. RDC is a statewide trade association comprised of individuals and companies from Alaska's fishing, forestry, mining, oil and gas, and tourism industries. RDC's membership includes Alaska Native corporations, local communities, organized labor, and industry support firms. RDC's purpose is to encourage a strong, diversified private sector in Alaska and expand the state's economic base through the responsible development of our natural resources. Senate Bill 85 provides the state with the ability to offer small volume timber sales with greater efficiency. It allows the State Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry with the ability to negotiate sales with any use of timber resources. Senate Bill 85 does away with the ability to appeal a forest land use plan, which in turn allows the state to conduct timber sales more efficiently without compromising required environmental review and public comment requirements and processes. RDC supports Senate Bill 85, which creates greater efficiency when it comes to responsible development of our natural resources. Thanks for the ability to comment today.
Thank you, Ms. Knorr. Next, we have Tessa Axelson, Executive Director of Alaska Forest Association. Tessa, please put yourself on the record and give us 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chairman Rivak, Vice Chairman Michiki, and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Tessa Axelson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Forest Association, commonly referred to as AFA. AFA is the Forest Products Trade Association that represents an array of members with an interest in the forest products industry in Alaska. I was born and raised in Alaska and reside in Ketchikan, where AFA's offices are currently located. We are constituents of Senator Bert Stedman. And it's my pleasure today to speak on AFA's behalf in support of Senate Bill 85. I'd just like to briefly give some background about our industry in support of the comments that were provided earlier by both Carrie and before her by forest representation from the Division of Forestry by State Forester Ng. AFA's members included but are not limited to timber operators, contractors, equipment suppliers, fuel distributors, tribal organizations, forest product vendors, sawmills, and other affiliated industry associations and private citizens. And as was discussed earlier during comments from State Forester Ng, what is most preemptively important to the industry is a reliance on predictable timber supply. And that reliance is from a variety of landowners that includes the state of Alaska, includes the federal government in the form primarily for our industry of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and its agency, the U.S. Forest Service. As we are all aware, the state of Alaska is held in less than 4% private ownership, and this means for the timber industry and the forest products industry in Alaska, we are heavily reliant on a variety of other landowners. So limitations on sales as a result of decisions and policies by our federal landowners, USDA and the U.S. Forest Service, as well as recent decisions by Secretary Vilsack with the announcement in July 2021, to substantially reduce old growth harvest and the transition to young growth, along with statements through the 2016 U.S. Forest Service Tongass Land Management Plan, as well as prevailing market conditions that were discussed earlier, necessitates state legislation that streamlines agency processes and ensures efficient forestry planning. The AFA is supportive of SB 85 as provided to the committee today for three primary reasons. First, that it provides for the Division of Forestry to negotiate sales with any use of timber resources, that the bill does away with inefficiencies that have existed with appeals to the FLUC or Forest Land Use Plan, while at the same time ensuring that there is no compromise to required environmental review and public comment requirements and processes that the division utilizes, and finally that the bill provides the state with the ability to offer small volume timber sales with greater efficiency. And overall, AFA would just share that these changes holistically help to ensure that our industry, which has continued to struggle, is able to support jobs in communities, to continue to operate efficiently, and to ensure that our small business operators have supply that allows them to continue operating in their various markets. I'm pleased to take any questions that you or the committee may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. I think if we have questions, we'll direct those to you at a future date. We have Mr. Ed Martin next. Ed, If you could please put yourself on the record again and give us 2 minutes.
Thank you again, Chairman Reebok, and my representative, who happens to be there, Peter. I'm glad you're there. Many of you senators should be fully aware that we've been fighting a situation I can remember going back in at least the 90s with the spruce bark beetle in South Central Alaska, not to mention the shutdown of the Tongass National Forest and many of those people that lost their jobs. I am full in support of this bill. In fact, I believe being uniquely qualified as a timber man, I, at 19 years old back in 1973, I had 2.25 million board feet of timber that I bought from the Matsu Borough. It was a very easy process. And in fact, it wasn't an easy process to get the trees to market. In fact, at that time, I had to build a road across a slough of the Big Sioux River to an island and then log it through the course of the summer by axes and by a boat, and then putting a logging winter road in. And all of that timber, much of it was cottonwood, some of it was saw logs, went to the Seward Mill. I used to have a pulp mill there. In the early 90s, I actually working for the Kenai Borough as the project manager to protect the community of Cooper Landing, and with funds from the legislature, was hired to get rid of a bunch of dead trees. A lot of them were still somewhat green, but we didn't do anything. The borough didn't have a program. They don't have a program today to deal with dead trees on their acres of land. This whole forest program under the management of forestry has been a dismal failure over the course of my life as an adult. Okay? And you folks have allowed a forest to go dead, and the sustained yield after a fire is almost zero. We do nothing to reforest forests after a fire or salvage from a fire where they do it down in the lower 48. You guys are way behind the curve on this thing, and you best quit talking about all the headaches that seems to be and streamline this like the governor's done for you. Act on this, pass it. And let's get about getting industry going in Alaska.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, that's a little bit over 2 minutes, Ed, but we appreciate your testimony. Thank you so much for testifying on both bills. Do we have anyone else online? I don't see anyone in the room who would like to testify. SB 85. All right, I don't see any. We're going to close public testimony. Public testimony on SB 85 is now closed. We're going to set both SB 85 and SB 79 aside to pick up at a future date. If any members of the committee have any comments or questions or anything we need to address offline, please get those to my office. Senator Stevens?
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the comments that Ed Martin made on House Bill 79. And we have tried in the past to increase out-of-state non-resident fees for commercial fisheries. I think we need to have a briefing, maybe from law, on that Carlson case and the implications of it and what we can do and how far we can go. It sounds like the House, I didn't hear that, but it sounds like House Finance, they were discussing it, and they set these fees on House Bill 79. At doubling, and I think we need to know what the recommendation is of the Department of Law on that. Is that enough? Can we go higher than that? Is that too much? We need to find that out.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Stevens. Any other comments before we move along? All right. On wrap up, thank you to the committee members for your attention and your flexibility today. Thank you to all the presenters as well. LIO staff, as always, Senate pages who helped with today's committee. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Friday, January 28, 2022, where we're going to have a committee update presentation from the Department of Natural Resources. And this meeting is now adjourned at 4:51 p.m.